Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to Counter Stories by people of color, for people of color, and everybody else. My name is Luz Maria Frias, and I'll be your host this morning. We are missing Halid Lee and Don Eubanks, part of our Counter Stories crew, who are off doing great things in the community and unable to join us today. But we have the great Tom Weber that we've missed.
It's great to be back. It's great to be back in the chair. And of course,
Anthony Galloway, CEO of Umoja Consulting.
So, Tom, you went down to Montgomery, Alabama to be a part of the grand opening of the National Peace and Justice Memorial Museum. And I know you've been working on various segments since you came back, and I know I followed a number of them and just was really struck by the power of that. So can you share with us how that's impacted you? And and also, as I was thinking on my way over here about our conversation, I kept thinking about the dissonance in your mind, and maybe this happens, you know, more often than not, but in particular for this, where you're on assignment, but you're a person. Yeah. And it, personally, how it impacted you as well.
No, it's really true. Because not only am I a person feeling it, but not only am I covering it, but I'm also on a bus for 98 hours because we left on a Tuesday and got back really late Saturday. So two of the four nights were on the bus. So, you know, like, just learn how to sleep on a bus, you know, that kind of thing. So there are a lot of things to navigate in addition to.
So you drew the short straw is what you're telling me.
But it was a great group of people. About three dozen people left from Duluth, went down to Montgomery. And, you know, we made some stops along the way. But, you know, there's really something. I had never been to Alabama in my life. And I think you've taken students to Montgomery.
Every year on bus trips. I think this year we flew, but every other year, I mean, I'm laughing at your 98 hours on a bus.
Yeah, because that's nothing.
Six states over a course of a week, way more than that. But
when I was down in Montgomery, Selma, and then Memphis for the 50th anniversary of the crossing of the Edmund Pettus Bridge.
Bloody Sunday.
Were you part of the, and then there was that whole march.
That contingency.
March the 50 miles. Yep. So just even before you talk about the memorial. And Anthony, I'm sure you have felt this too, but being in a place like Montgomery, which is the state capital, which is, there were some really powerful moments of, as you, for example, the steps where the state capital is, are the steps that Martin Luther King spoke at the end of that Selma march.
Look down the street and see the church.
And then right kitty corner is the church where he preached. But Montgomery was also the first capital of the Confederacy, which I hadn't remembered from history class. Not sure I learned that in history class because I'd always remembered Richmond. So those were the same steps where Jefferson Davis gave his inauguration as president of the Confederacy and where the first inaugural parade of the Confederacy took place. The same street.
I was going to say, and drawing those connections that history doesn't do well for us as students, if you will, of history,
right,
whether in school or even just in life. And it isn't until kind of you're a grown man, I don't want to say what your age is, but you have this epiphany when you go down there.
There was one site, one marker not far from the new museum, the lynching museum, where on one side of the marker was on this site in such and such a year, something happened related to the Confederacy. And as you just turn around, walk around to the other side of the, usually these are one-sided monuments, but as you turn around on this site in such and such a year, something happened related to the Civil Rights Movement. Same site. And you have this moment of, frankly, in the work I do in journalism, of wanting to live in the nuance, You cannot paint a broad brush. You cannot say that the people of Montgomery are blank. You can't say one way or another. You can't say that this is only the place of the Confederacy, because think of all the other history that has happened there. And so when that merges and meshes, it leaves me, I have not written the book yet on how people should feel about Montgomery or what to do with that.
You know, historically, I would say so much of our time and resources, both public money and private money, have been spent on building historical markers to identify and memorialize mainstream culture, mm-hmm. meaning dominant society, meaning white. Mm-hmm. And few resources and initiatives have been used to commemorate African American or Black or any other Native American, and the list mm-hmm. goes on, type of markers. So when you look at an area such as Montgomery or mm-hmm. others, the building of this museum is that much more significant because of the need to really validate the ugliness and the terrorism and the anguish and everything else that you can associate with lynching of over 4,000 people.
Well, I mean, and this is that asterisk in the nuance that you just spoke to, right? Mm-hmm. When you look at Alabama in this particular area between Montgomery, Selma, and Birmingham, you have the Bloody Sunday in Birmingham. You have the Voting Rights Institute right across from 16th Street Baptist Church, where the Four Little Girls are bound. You have all these different sites that were kicked to the forefront of our psyche because it was the site that was used to do that. I mean, these sites are there and this attention is there because the Southern Christian Leadership Council, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and all these places centered on Alabama because it was a place where folks were just unabashed enough with just enough safety to be able to highlight this in the national stage. But they're all monuments to Black suffering and the suffering of folks, right? And so there's that asterisk in there that, great, we're getting these memorials, but it always comes with that nuanced asterisk of, in mentioning African Americans, the amount that honor the positive, lived, beautiful experience of us pale in comparison to the monuments to our suffering.
Well, and even in Montgomery, so you have the new lynching memorial and museum. They are, by the way, separate locations. They're a few blocks from each other, just so people can put that in their mind. But, you know, Montgomery is also home to the Rosa Parks Museum. That's where she refused to give up her seat. You've talked about this, that moment.
That planned moment.
Yep. There's also the Freedom Rides Museum, because Montgomery is where one of the places where when the bus arrived, they all got the you-know-what beat out of them after they got off the bus. Mm-hmm. But maybe, Anthony, to your point, what I heard you say from my lived experience was, these are moments, you need a Rosa Parks Museum, you need a museum for the Freedom Rides, but we're memorializing them because those were moments that were important and became important even in white America, whereas this new lynching memorial, I don't sense that's something white America really wants to talk about.
And that's what makes it intriguing. We were in Selma. We were trying to figure out a way to get over there, but site hadn't opened yet, and we were pulling every arm we could of folks we built there over time to try to get students over there, because we had a bus load of students who were doing their civil rights research experience. So we chose to go to the 50th anniversary over in Memphis instead. But one of the conversations that they had was their excitement about the Lynching Museum is, instead of just yet another museum that does a really important job of telling an important story of the struggle, this is one that is going to force folks to look up into the most ugly example of that lived, overt, racist past. And they're really excited to see that, partly for the uncomfortability that it will make for other folks.
So you've got these markers that are suspended from, the top. To illustrate, duplicate what it was to be lynched either from a tree or a flagpole or anything other like that, with names of individuals, right, and the date of their lynching is my understanding. And what struck me when I was reading about that was humanizing of these individuals for who they are as people rather than a big, broad brush of the word lynching.
There's 800 actual we've been calling them pillars or slabs or memorials. Each of them are 6 feet long, the length of a coffin. Wow. So it's 800 to represent the counties.
Got it.
So 4,000 people over these 800 counties. Mm. So one county's slab might only have one name, but then Hinds County, Mississippi, where Jackson is, has more than 20 on the same slab. And the interesting thing about how it's presented is you actually have to walk up a hill to get to it. And when you first enter the memorial, these slabs are on the ground. They are not suspended. They're like
those are the duplicate ones.
No. This is actually the start of the experience.
Ah.
These are part of the memorial. They look like gravestones. And then the memorial, as it goes in a square, goes down. The grade goes down so that very slowly these slabs start to take on the appearance of suddenly hanging and being suspended from the air.
Okay.
So by the time you're at the second or third turn, and if you saw Oprah on 60 Minutes, right, there was that shot where she turns, she says, oh my goodness, like that's that moment where now you're at the maximum depth, which means that all of these slabs are just hanging. They're just suspended there.
Just even in here you described, there are, I was doing some research. A lot of these museums are designed very similarly. You'll see some parallels between the National Civil Rights Museum and a lot of the other museums. You'll see some kind of carrying motifs for how they're designed as you walk through them. And so you'll see all that. They'll look recognizable when you go. But I was standing and looking at a panel, and the panel only went from 1820 to about 1860. And I was looking at one panel, and I was like, oh, wow, they got all these lynchings that are listed here. And this is just the men who were lynched, so not including the women. And then I stepped out and looked to the side and realized that this panel was not only double-sided, but there were 9 of them going back. Mm. And they were just records of lynchings in Mississippi, which in comparison to Alabama, for lynchings and for other violence, you know,
way more
happened there. That's why I was saying Alabama was this interesting nexus where there were still some horrible things that happened that you could highlight, but you weren't assured death if you were to come out.
So where was this that you saw these?
This is in Jackson, Mississippi.
That's in Jackson.
So
yep.
That's interesting because you just mentioned the year 1820, right? Mm-hmm. So for the purposes of this new memorial.
In Montgomery,
it's 1877 to 1950.
Yes. Right.
So this doesn't even include those lynchings you're saying.
And it doesn't include, for example, Emmett Till.
Yep.
Because he died after 1950. And I heard someone at the memorial say, actually, Emmett Till isn't in this memorial, not only because he doesn't fit the time range, but because actually his death did spark a reaction, whereas all of these you see before you didn't.
And we have other examples, too. There's a young man in Texas who was dragged behind a car until he was dismembered. There was 1981 in Michigan. There's another. So there are things that aren't included here. And one of the questions I had is this just lynchings within the subjugation of African peoples in the United States? Or does this include the many Latino and Native folks who have been lynched across the country as well?
This is black lynching only.
Okay.
It doesn't include whites, Natives, Latinos, any other racial group. It's only black lynching.
I had a similar question in my mind as well, because we know at the border for decades there were hundreds of Latinos who were lynched as well.
Oh, yeah. And not just the border, but that number spikes right in that area, right?
But if you think about the issue of mass incarceration and the connection to the privatization of prisons around our country, not only for mass incarceration of black and brown bodies, but also the mass incarceration of those that are being held for immigration purposes. There was a movement, and it's tied to SB 1070 in Arizona.
And that was the law that said cops can or must ask about immigration status when they pull you over or something like that.
And having then prisons be the detention centers for immigrants, undocumented integrants. So it's feeding into all that. And again, Michelle Alexander does a really nice job, at least with the African-American community, and tying that all together.
And just to put myself into the shoes that I just called out, right? This kind of dual notion of I'm glad there's something that is going to make us face this face on, head on, but then also having had the narratives that have been around forever and a day, not kind of sink in. I've had that same experience with me in regards to immigration for the Chicano strand of our civil rights research experience. We were going through Colorado, and there was this art museum that had this exhibit that was a recreation of detention centers, where the artist had recreated the kind of metallic blankets that are given. And so you walk in and you see the sleeping areas with these people laying there, but it's art, it's bodies and art made out of these materials, and you get to stand in the place. And I got to stand in the recreation of one of these detention centers and read the notes that were left and taken from these detention centers in this room with students who had that experience. And it was every bit as sobering and grounding. And it's, to this day, I'm like, it's connected to me in a way that now I have a better understanding when we engage in this discourse around immigration, what that detention center experience looks like. I have to imagine that is a kind of a proxy or is analogous to what you describe in seeing this memorial.
And it also seems to me, when you think about what I do or don't have to experience in life as a white person, if, to your point, Luz, about this memorial, this is a very as I understand it from the people who run the museum and memorial, 1877 and 1950, that's a very purposeful time frame, because if you go to the museum, which is called the Legacy Museum, mm-hmm. which again is a separate, it's a few blocks mm-hmm. away. Mm-hmm. They had shuttles set up. It's a little far to walk. The purpose of that time frame, 1877 to 1950, is because this museum and this organization, the Equal Justice Initiative, is absolutely very definitively trying to draw a very thick line. Mm-hmm. You know, the mantra of this organization, Equal Justice Initiative, is that slavery never ended, it mm-hmm. just evolved. And I don't know if they're the first organization or person to say that, but that is something that they say very loudly.
And so that becomes important. Then those years become a very important benchmark. Yes. 1877, the end of Reconstruction.
Exactly.
And the beginning of the implementation of slavery in a new way through prison labor, through
mass incarceration.
Yeah, prison labor, mass incarceration, but also the Jim Crow. And then
a racial caste system, exactly. as it was referred to in one of the museum panels.
When I went through So I went through a museum in Birmingham, mm-hmm. the small civil rights museum they have. Then I went to the Memphis, the
National Civil Rights Museum.
Adjacent to the Lorraine Hotel. And the Memphis one, of course, had much more in terms of what I would call an asset-based type of displays, you know, and celebrating the strengths of the African-American history and people and accomplishments interweaved with all the hard stuff, right? But when I went through that and came out, the first thought that I had was every person living in our country needs to go through that museum.
In the DC Museum and in the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, it's very important, and even Jackson, there's a very important piece where you walk in and you walk out of what you said, the hard stuff, right? Mm-hmm. You get face to face with some of the worst experiences, and then you get a chance to walk out and decompress, right? For those reasons, those stand out to me and a lot of the students who we visit with a lot less than the Voting Rights Museum in Selma, that's right on the other side of the Edmund Pettus Bridge, the Civil Rights Institute in Birmingham. And what I've assumed about this from what I've read and with family members who have gone to this memorial so far have all spoken to is the inability to put things down at the end.
I think that's so interesting, because I may even use a controversial word, because this bus trip also stopped in Memphis. So we also went to the mm-hmm. National Civil Rights Museum, which it's built into the hotel where right. Martin Luther King was shot. They've reworked that area where you can kind of be in the hotel room looking out, kind of, you know what I mean, when you're in that room. I think they did actually a pretty good job of it. But with that museum and with the National Smithsonian one, it seems like there's a little bit of whitewashing going on. Because, for example, on the Smithsonian one,
I'm feeling some kind of way because you used a word that I try to stay away from for niceness.
I'm going for it.
Because I'm in his NPR studio.
but for example, the Smithsonian, the national one on the National Mall, you have this heavy moment down on the slave ship on the ground floor where you go and you see the little handcuffs that were the child's handcuffs on a slave ship. Mm-hmm. But by the time you're about to leave, you're learning about Aretha Franklin and the place that black music has played in American culture, which is a great lesson to learn.
Different museum for different purpose, though, because I have to also – I have to nuance, you know, my statement with that feeling. And that feeling speaks to more of a pattern I have about wanting to get to some happy at the end of facing this stuff. But the D.C. Museum, one of the things that makes that a little bit different for me is just that that is a museum of the African experience, African-American experience.
True.
So you're going to get all of the pieces of the story together. So if you are doing justice to that, you will end up in a space of honoring beauty and awesomeness because – that's part and parcel.
Not so in Montgomery.
Not so in some of the other museums. And I personally like when a museum leaves you leaving without the ability to put away the hard stuff. Because when you get out of the DC Museum, depending on if you start at the top or the bottom, most they suggest you start at the bottom,
go
on the elevator and come up.
And go up.
So you can leave the slave ship in the Middle Passage experience at the bottom when you get to the top in that reflection space. The Civil Rights Museum in Birmingham, when you get done with the museum, it may end with all these other justice movements that are continuing, but you end with the case for the folks who killed those four little girls, and you end looking out the window at the 16th Street Baptist Church in Freedom Park where the water hoses were unleashed.
Right.
And so you can walk away with all that hope and stuff like that, but you have to temper it in the I'm borrowing here from some scholars, but you got to temper it in the fire of reality.
This new museum, the museum portion of what's happening in Montgomery here with the Legacy Museum, which again is more downtown area in Montgomery, is located on a site that apparently was once a warehouse that just warehoused slaves before they were sold at the auction block a couple blocks away. And so when you walk into the museum, the first thing that happens is you go down into this little corridor where they have these holograms as if there are slaves in each of these cells, right? And there's these holograms of slaves. I mean, they're actors obviously portraying, but like the one on the far left, I think, is a mom saying, "They took my children. Where's my children? You know, I don't know what I'm doing here." And then the one on the far right is the two kids saying, "We don't know where my mom is." You know, and it's like...
And that area was designed based on an experience that actually runs right by the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. So Miss Joanne Bland does regular walks through that area, who was there on Bloody Sunday when she was 11 years old when it happened. She's the founder of the Voting Rights Museum that's on the other end. And then there's a woman named Miss Afriye We Can Do This, and she changed her name to that.
Wow.
And she does a very powerful simulation in a very similar way where you get off of your bus or whatever you're coming there with, and you simulate the separation piece that's happened, the dehumanization piece, and she walks you through that. And then you have a kind of almost a really surreal in the dark experience hearing all those sounds firsthand right there. Yeah. It's a powerful experience.
This museum is so small, Anthony, that there's no room for decompression. It's this little corridor I talked about with these holograms, and then it's the main room, and that's basically it. It's not that big. So you turn the corner, you come into the main room, and then you are immediately, I mean, just hit upside the head with the line from slavery to lynching to segregation to mass incarceration.
It's powerful.
And they say that that is the legacy. The Legacy Museum, the legacy of slavery, is what we're talking about today with mass incarceration. I mean, I have never had that line drawn for me with such a thick marker.
And there's so much to unpack here.
There's something important there. Drawn with a thick marker. I can think of countless resources and experience, and this is just some of the dissonance that I feel when I hear this piece of it, because there's so many examples of that. With thin markers to big giant Sharpies and bullseyes written around in red marker for me, that makes this experience or this trip that we'll be taking there much more of a memorial. But I'm constantly hearing friends, in particular white friends who didn't have that same understanding of the extent to which this was part of our lives, coming back with this very informative experience. And they would describe it very similarly. Never have I had it painted for me that. And I always come back to the question, well, how it takes this to paint that?
Well, we weren't looking for it, Anthony.
But if you think about Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, I mean, she did a fabulous job pulling that together. And there are other books that we can point to that comes to that as well. But mainstream media, whether it's private media, commercialized media, or NPR and all of their subsidiaries, don't spend that level of time and effort drawing that line for a dominant society. So it's not, in my understanding, mm-hmm. in my humble opinion, it's not until you as a reader or as mm-hmm. someone who's in this space are making, those...
The active
mm-hmm. effort and schooling yourself yeah. to have that understanding.
And it also seems to me when you think about what I do or don't have to experience in life as a white person, If a black person has a victim of lynching in his or her family history, do you?
Yeah, oh yeah. Several.
So, and you know this. You yes. know the history.
Oh, yeah.
If my family history has ever included people who were part of the mob, we have the privilege of not having to tell that story. The police chief of Duluth found this out. Almost accidentally, that he is related to the woman in Duluth who made the charge of rape against the three men who were they later lynched. Her story was never found to be credible, including by the doctor who examined her. And the current police chief of Duluth, Mike Tuscan, who talked to me and has talked very openly about this, says, I didn't know this history.
That was his great aunt.
That was his great aunt who... made the accusation that led to these three men in Duluth being lynched in what is the only documented case of black lynching in Minnesota.
And they actually incarcerated six black yeah. men, and they were circus workers. And the mob came in the dark, of the night
yeah.
and snatched three of them, kidnapped them, for lack of a better word. They got three of them out. The three remained in, and the three were lynched.
I mean, it hit close to home, even in family. Our own mayor in St. Paul, his great-grandfather, was a trumpeter in the circus and went through Duluth, So this understanding that, given location and timing, that could have been great-grandfather, which would have had huge implications on the family going forward. Like, we're never that far removed from this. And again, we're only talking about the things that hit the definition of lynching that we have ascribed to.
Exactly.
Because we're not talking about smaller group murders that happen. I'm actually working on a project right now with a local actor, James Williams, where he's going through and looking at three generations of absent fathers in his life, and he goes to research his grandfather's story and figures out that his grandfather was one of many black railroad firemen who were murdered to make way for white workers during the competition post-Depression. Is that not racially motivated and not connected to racially motivated killings? I mean, it may not fit all the parameters we have to check to make it into this box of
to call it a lynching,
but if we wanted to say lynching and murders, we wouldn't be talking yeah. about 4,000. We'd yeah. be talking about a much higher number.
In Duluth, by the way, that crowd that was at the lynching is estimated to have been 10,000. Mm-hmm. Well, Duluth had about 100,000 at the time, so that's 1 in 10 Duluthians, mm-hmm. assume, give or take. Think about all the people who live in Duluth now who are white, who have only great or great great grandfathers or aunts who lived in Duluth at that time. This is 1920.
Well, and the other stark observation coming out of that, too, was that they took photographs and used them as postcards.
But the trip we took stopped in Cairo, Illinois on the way down.
Really?
Because there was a lynching in Cairo, Illinois in 1909. Mm-hmm. That lynching, too, which was far more disturbing. It was actually led by women, and they desecrated mm-hmm. the body after it was hanged.
They burned it,
and there's yeah. a whole
well,
lot.
That was an uncommon practice.
But that was also made a postcard.
Yeah.
So let's say the history of the Duluth lynching. Let's say that they made postcards out of it, and you think, oh, well, I'm kind of informed about this. No. Part of this museum is to say, the more we lynch, the more we stay the same. Right. There's no uniqueness to some of these lynchings. Yeah. It's a pattern. It's the same
thing. It's a pattern, and it's also clearly used to terrorize people, right? To terrorize the black community in terms of not living there or mm-hmm. living under only certain circumstances in subjugation, you know, racially, from a public policy point of view, economically, housing, the list goes on. But this was terrorism at its and we
you were going to say at its best, but
well, you know, at its worst, at its harshest. But as a society and in the history books, that's not how we talk about it.
And I just I'm in terms of especially this definition, like this opens the door to some of the kind of more there's a pattern or a style of racially motivated killings of Black people. And we've already acknowledged that this happened in many other communities as well who have been marginalized. But I got to think about Tulsa. I got to think about Seneca Village, which is where Central Park is now, a Black community that was removed forcefully with violence in order to put something else there. Well, in addition to the fact that it's not just the people who pulled the string or not just the people where they had a physical hand on lynching the folks, but all of those bystanders.
Families would gather at lynchings to watch that and bring their food along and make a family event out of it.
And so, you know, like I said, just scratching the surface with the memorial, are we really, can we go deeper into the conversation about not just the perpetrators, not just the visual aspects of it, but all the folks who were bystanders there, because every bystander there was a silent approval of this, especially for the postcard picture, which made this an option for many other folks. Can we be willing to talk about that?
Imagine 10,000 people aiding and abetting this. And let's go back to Duluth. This was a mob of Duluthians. Yeah. It wasn't led by law enforcement. Mm. Now, you know, you can infer that law enforcement didn't do much to stop it. All right, so there was some acquiescence there, but you've got a mob that rushes into the jail cells and kidnaps these circus workers and snatches them and then lynch them publicly. So you've got that act, and my reading is that they were charged with inciting riot, but they were never charged for the murders
and the lynching. Right. And as one side note to that is that the history is that the year after Duluth happened, Minnesota did pass an anti-lynching law. There was enough shame somewhere in the psyche that they passed an anti-lynching law, and there never were lynchings again.
But those folks should have been tried for murder.
Yeah. They were, it was like inciting a riot was the charge.
Inciting a riot,
like
right.
And it's deep in our history. You know, we in Minnesota... you know, there's a whole lot of things for us to come to terms with as a state. I mean, we had a governor actually put out action sanction the killing of Dakota peoples mm-hmm. and the turning in of the scalps of those people at Fort Snelling.
For
you
money.
Know, the fact that we had $200, there's an interesting mm-hmm. Picture at the Historical Society of a receipt of a payment that was turned in. So to think back of, you know, do I have grandparents that were at one of these lynchings, you know, in Minnesota, we have to think back, do I have a homestead that was partially paid for or saved by the killing of a Dakota person in this, you know, after the 1862 uprising, you know, or even the fact that sits at the site of the largest concentration camp for Native Americans in the history of the United States. And all of that sits on the sacred creation and origin story for Dakota peoples, the Bedote. Right.
Fort Snelling,
you know,
which is
at Fort Snelling, right in that area. And so, you know, and that is overlooked by a ridge of mounds that stretch for miles in millions of remains of people. I think we're down to three or four official that haven't been disturbed.
Up in Mounds Park in St. Paul. Yeah.
Right. And so, that ridge extended a long way. And so, you know, we have a lot of things to come to terms with. So whenever I see the things like this memorial, that's part of the thing that excites me, because it gives me a feeling that there is a place somewhere that is at least making it impossible for us to dance around.
You know, I also thought of when I was on the trip, of all people, my colleague Kathy Wozzer, because if you listen to her in the morning, she sometimes does this on Today in History, and it's a lot, sometimes it's Minnesota history. So at some point in the future, she's going to say, on this day, and I don't remember the year, the Split Rock Lighthouse was lit for the first time up near Two Harbors. And Kathy loves the North Shore, so she'll always talk about Split Rock. But it just so happens I walked past one of these slabs with the same date as the initial lighting of the Split Rock Lighthouse. So on the day, so now when I hear Kathy, whenever Kathy says that in the future, whenever I think of the Split Rock Lighthouse and the first day it was ever lit, I will think,
oh yeah, that's the day that 15 unknown to this day men were lynched in Texas.
So that really begs the question, again, going back to how media frames history, right? And the reality of this is that unless we become more transparent on sharing the ugliness of our history, we can't begin the process of reconciliation, and we can't have that acknowledgement. And I think about Australia. They have a National Reconciliation Day annually where the government acknowledges the wrongs that they have perpetrated against the indigenous people there. And it's part of the healing process, and they do this every year. And the big question is, why haven't we stepped up to that plate as a nation, but even yet as a state here in the U.S.? Because we, in my view, we need to do that. We can't move beyond this. And we do a lot in terms of talking about race and equipping people and training people as racial justice facilitators at YWCA Minneapolis. But we're one small cog, you know, in the wheel of potential. And Anthony's been doing this work for decades, and other leaders in the community similarly speaking. But in order for us to begin to move forward, we've got to have something that really allows us to do that.
Well, it's 2018. In 2 years, almost exactly in 2 years, that will be 100 years since the lynching in Duluth. So does the state start now with some kind of commission on how we're going to remember the 100th anniversary of the Duluth lynching? I don't know the answer to that.
I think we do. And the important piece of that, so there's some things that come up just in your body when you start to look at trauma like this, historical trauma. And there can be an ask or a push to say, you know, I don't want to look at this bad stuff as if that somehow addressing this will make it less possible for you to honor the history of the Split Rock Lighthouse, mm-hmm. right? That somehow knowing that same year somebody else was lynched.
Same day.
Yeah. It's going to intrude upon your fond memory of something else. Well, people of color have been living through face to face with this trauma forever, and it hasn't diminished our ability to honor and love the great things that have happened throughout our lives. There's also a space where we're not going to put down the trauma or the horrible things as well, because all of it is important, and you can hold both of those at the same time. And I think that's new. It's becoming a new thing to have to deal with the more memorials like this come up.
Well, and wouldn't it be easier to move beyond that if things were 100% great for the African-American community now? We're living in some of the most dire situations and circumstances in terms of economic inequality, wealth inequality, income inequality, unemployment, education, the list goes on. So where is the impetus to begin to let go if circumstances haven't really drastically improved?
And I'll add, the let go isn't the forgetting. And that's the important piece, right? I can get to a place where I can honor the tragic past and the trauma that I've experienced. Even myself, when I think of certain things that happened in childhood that stay or remain with me in trauma, I never forget those, will never forget those pieces. But I'm able to live in a space of knowing and never forgetting, but still looking forward. That's that kind of essence or spirit of Sankofa.
Can I, because you brought up trauma, that is actually something that happened on the trip that I wanted to share, because that was a moment of reflection for me too. And I actually have a bit of audio from people that I interviewed on the trip. And I thought we could just play them right after each other. The first person you're going to hear is a woman in her 70s named Portia Johnson, very well known in the African-American community in Duluth, civil rights. She actually has a street named after her in Duluth as well. Then you're going to hear from Kim Young right after that, who's from Superior, Wisconsin. She actually founded an organization that runs the Juneteenth celebration in
Wisconsin.
In Superior, yeah. So you're going to hear them right after, you know, and Portia's soundbite is right after seeing the statue, right when you come into the memorial, before you get to these pillars that we were talking about. It's a statue depicting the moment of a man being chained and torn from his family, and the wife is crying. And it's a man who is either a slave or about to become a slave, and it's this raw moment.
You know what? It almost makes me want to cry just to see just that
statue
of the slaves, of the mom with the baby in her arms reaching out to her husband because he is in bondage. It makes me almost want to cry. It really, really does.
And then the second soundbite is Kim a little farther down the trail when we're in the memorial. She's just come into the memorial, and she's just seen these slabs for the first time.
It makes it hard to grasp, but at the same time, we're grateful, you know, that their stories are being told, that they're no longer silent from the grave. Just, I don't know if I'm able to really articulate yet. I mean, I'm angry. I'm excited. I'm sad. I'm hopeful.
So when you use the word trauma, Anthony, I think about the time I was hit by a car, and it was actually a pretty minor incident. The guy was stopped at the light, so he wasn't going very fast. I broke a thumb. But I remember for the first few months afterwards, whenever I heard a car squeal, I'd jump. That's the kind of PTSD version of trauma that I think of when I think of the word trauma, that I had very temporarily after that happened to me earlier in life. But this is a different kind of trauma that I didn't experience when I was at that memorial. It was very powerful to be there, but I don't think the chemistry of my body changed. I don't think I had a deleterious health effect to my body just by being in there. And I got a sense that for the white people at the memorial that weekend, that's true. And for others of African heritage, this is also, a spark.
Well, let me complicate that further for you, then.
Okay, go for
it. Because if we're having these conversations and things aren't complicated, we're not going deep enough. That's for me. I'm going to go back to what you said earlier about knowing or having a feeling or inkling that somebody in your family as a white person could have been there and witnessed and partook in that space. And then you think about the stories. This is how it comes to me. I have stories that I overheard from when I was a kid at the feet of elders and stuff like that. Folks that they would only hint at and not talk about and all these things because they didn't want to pass along
the trauma.
The tragedy.
Oh, okay.
Of it. And I say that particularly for a reason that you'll hear in a second. And then I encounter stories that are so similar, and all of a sudden the pieces fall on the line of folks that get aunties and grandmas we're talking about that I didn't know who they're talking about, but now I know the history in the area of Mississippi that they're talking about, or the West Virginia that they're talking about, or Texas that they're talking about. And now I start to put all these pieces together, and then you go back and you piece together as many questions, and then older folks are going, oh yeah, yeah, that was so-and-so, and they were killed here or murdered here or lynched here. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh. And I feel it immediately in my gut,
in your stomach,
right here, because now I have to go back and look about the things that could have been. And then there's an anger that frustration that comes up. And then all the way you have a different part of your brain who's telling you, but you can't do anything about that. That was in the past. You're here now. Here are all the things to celebrate and like. And it gets, there's this complicated feeling of all these different things. And then you start to look at where you are in life, where your family is, where they could have been. Because a lot of times these lynchings coincide with the huge loss of wealth and stability for a family that now has to go in. I could have been a family that had built a home owned outright by the time it got to my generation. But that was removed because for some of us, and for example, in Mississippi at the time, the name, there are women who had to adopt their own children because all the stuff was in the man's name. And when that man dies, so too the property claims go to, unless a judge was able to put that back into your place because some of the draconian laws are in place. All of that comes together at once and it lives in your body. I would imagine that as a white person, knowing that I might have had family there, and I would go back and I'll think of what my morals or sensibilities are now versus what was happening then. I don't have to contend with the fact that somebody was there and either was participated or gave approval to this thing. And I have to either speak that into existence and deal with that or hold it in. And that itself presents a level of things that can sit with you psychologically and hold in there. And I see that fight or flight visited upon kids in some of my programs where they go to these sites and then have to unpack that same question.
What comes to mind, Anthony, as you're describing this, is the issue of epigenetics and the amount of research that's out there that in essence says the trauma that your ancestors experienced is passed through genetically from one generation to another generation.
And physiologically.
Physiologically. Right? Yeah. And that you can't divest yourself from that. And that you're not fully aware it's in you until there's a trigger. As you are saying, Anthony, then you have this visceral reaction that comes about. And that this is a trauma generationally that exists in various communities because of the atrocities that have been perpetrated against them, whether it's the African-American community, the Native American community, the Latino community, you know, the list goes on, the Asian community here in the States, where all this is part of who we are and the need for then not only validation of it as a society, and again, going back to the issue of reconciliation and the importance of being able to have that officially part of who we are as a nation, but also the importance then of self-care and mental health treatments for that.
But it also means that with the privilege I have to not have to ask about the history, I don't have to research, or do I? Like, what
I
was
think,
I think
Anthony is challenging you on that.
But I mean, have to, right? That whole idea or understanding, and this is one of the things that has been percolating since I've been pondering that. I don't have to. Well, you do, actually. And it's not regardless of what you may be able to do or maybe to do in this lifetime, that is not a long-term process that's sustainable, not being able to visit. To reflect on this, you may be able to run and not acknowledge for a time, but there's a point where you can't run anymore and it's going to hit you.
But in the short term, not having researched that before I went to Alabama, I mean, you could argue physiologically, I left that site healthier than some of the people who were experienced this really raw in the gut moment, right?
Although, the other side of that would be really digging deep and asking yourself, are your hands clean? I know I would be asking myself. And my background, because my parents are from Mexico, I know for certainty that we were not a part of these atrocities here in the U.S. But if I were in your shoes, my question would be to myself, do I have clean hands? And do my ancestors have clean hands in all this? And not knowing would be worse than knowing in my mind and trying to reconcile that. Because when we talk about privilege, privilege means being able to get up and walk out and think, you know, you don't have that baggage.
Right.
But asking yourself the tough questions about, can I really be sure? I mean, much like the chief in Duluth, he didn't know.
He didn't.
Right? For most of his life is what I understand the write-up that I read about. And then he struggled with, do I come clean or do I continue to live kind of in the shadows? And so it's my understanding he decided to be forthright with the truth. And I think that gets him closer on the healing journey that he's got to go through. But if I were in other people's shoes, it'd be a tough pill for me to
swallow.
If
you're white and you live in Duluth and you have family that goes back to the 1920s, there's a 1 in 10 chance they were there. I mean, it's just that, that's just the math of it.
And you got to, you have to get to a point of embracing that, right? You know, on a road to recovery in any kind of way, you have to acknowledge the pain. You have to acknowledge what's going on. And I think that's an important piece to think about this memorial as. How can I use this experience to dig in and embrace the real history. Because at the end of that comes a pattern. Because of things I've experienced, there are patterns that become apparent very quickly for me. And we can act and start to see the signs for them right away. And I think that embracing that, this becomes one of those things. When I hear the stories that lead up to these different lynchings, it may not be an overt, violent loss of life that we see now, although there are some proxies that we can utilize for. The mentality around, mentality behind what became a process of lynching or a pattern or a choice of behavior of folks, we can see that pattern early on. The more we can embrace this history, the more we can lean into that. And so if you wanted to figure out how do I see these patterns, get in and embrace it and jump all the way in and lean into that. Because then it's not so much that I get, for me, it's not so much that folks finally acknowledge, oh, this happened. But now folks can start to acknowledge the mentality and the pattern that led up to. And that's the important get for me for a memorial like this.
And feeling comfortable with being very uncomfortable,
yes,
has always been kind of what I tell folks, the takeaway in talking about race. You got to really feel uncomfortable and get through that and expect that is part of the healing process, part of the growth process, building that muscle within your body that will allow you to then move forward. So thank you for another great conversation on Counter Stories. I'm Luz Maria Frias, President and CEO of YWCA Minneapolis.
Anthony Galloway, CEO of Moja Consulting.
And Tom Weber from NPR News.
We'll see you next time. This is America. Don't catch you slipping, no. Don't catch you slipping, no.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.